You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Azam Abu Hawil, a Jordanian-Palestinian, recently found himself again under arrest by INS agents. During his arrest, Hawil asserted that he was informed by the agents that he was being arrested because he refused to act as an informant for the FBI. According to Muslim American Society Executive Director Mahdi Bray, Hawil is simply one of many Arabs and Muslims who have been singled out for what he termed clearly a case of harassment and intimidation by the U.S. government. Peace Watch spoke with Bray today regarding the status of Hawil's detention by the INS.
Azam Abu Hawil was basically represented by people who represented themselves as attorneys in 1994 to deal with his status here in the United States. It turns out that they were actually paralegals posing as lawyers, and as a result, they didn't file the necessary papers. So in 2000, he was picked up. To make a long story short, being picked up, basically, he was released on a bond, $10,000 bond. And since then, he's complied in every way with the INS. He's married to a U.S. citizen. He has currently pending approval of residency status. And as a result of that, he's basically should be entitled to stay in the United States. And basically what's taking place now is procedural. His lawyers are reapplying for a joint motion to have his deportation orders quashed, and as a result of that, that he will be able to stay here. But in the interim, what has happened is that he's been approached by the FBI on several occasions, asked to be an informant. And having refused to do that and not willing to participate in some type of informant or snitchers program, his bond all of a sudden was mysteriously revoked. And basically he was told, in so many words, by the persons who took him back to detention in Arlington, Virginia, that his bond was being revoked because he was not cooperating with the FBI.
Well, what do you mean in so many words? I mean, is it legal to do that, to revoke a person's bond because they will not comply with serving as a FBI informant?
The only way that I know of it, technically, and I'm not a lawyer, but as a layperson, the only understanding I have legally, if a person has agreed and there were some conditions that he was working with the government, there were certain things he was supposed to perform as a condition for his release. This was not his case at all. He was never released as an informant. He was never given any orders to report to the FBI or provide the FBI with information and things of that nature. So that's the only way I know legally that it could be done, but it's tantamount to government extortion.
Mm. And so can he prove that this occurred to him? Does he have anything in writing that would back up his allegation?
The only thing he has in writing is that there's no reason for him to be detained. And everything else is anecdotal. And as you know, the government always, in these cases, they hide the ball. You know, basically, it's almost like the Abbott and Costello, who's on first? When you go and ask the INS, it says, well, check with the FBI. You check with the FBI. We don't know anything. Check with the INS, you know. And so it's this vicious cycle of nobody seems to know anything. But he is adamant about the fact that the reason for his detention was simply because he would not be an informant.
Did he say exactly to what degree they requested his spying services? Does he go into detail about that?
Well, he doesn't go into detail, and I think, you know, in terms of the client-attorney privilege, that perhaps that might not be available publicly at this time. But I do know for a fact that he was able to say that the INS officers who were arresting him and taking him into detention merely indicated, saying that you are not working with the FBI and we're going to revoke your bond.
Mm. So is it possible, Mahdi Bray, that under this new climate of the Patriot Act and Homeland Security, that it's legal for the INS to revoke his bond on the basis of his not cooperating with the FBI as an informant?
No, there's no law to support that. Basically, once again, these are the what I call the extraordinary steps in the climate of the Patriot Bill and the climate of what I call post 9/11 hysteria, that government will do certain things that they shouldn't do. But this is nothing new. We know that through COINTELPRO and throughout the history, that government actually, in times of hysteria and in times of heightened national security type of concerns, that government will take extra legal and judiciary steps beyond what their bounds are constricted by according to law. So we do know that. And so this is what's happening. And it's not the only case. I've had many cases where I've talked with individuals who merely indicated that They may have had a technical violation or whatever, but the technical violation was being used as a way to recruit them to be a spy or an informer. And I think that's horrible. I think it's horrible to, for the Muslim community to be treated that way, as if we're less loyal or some fifth column here in America, and you can't depend upon the Muslim community to be able to let people know about anything that would be of pertinent interest in terms of national security, because after all, everybody wants to be secure. Nobody wants to have anything horrific to happen to them or the society in which they live. And for some reason, to assume that Muslims, for some reason, are less concerned about safety and of their community is, I think, racist and also smacks of religious bigotry.
And so when you say many of your clients, or you know of many cases where the FBI has approached Muslims to spy on the community, can you give us a ballpark figure? How many?
Well, I can't give you a ballpark figure, but I can tell you this. I know that in my personal files, I have just in my personal files, just locally here in the area and a few cases across the country, I have at least no less than 100 cases or more of people who have been approached by the FBI and asked to be informants. I have one case that's horrible where a woman who's asked not to be identified, who's an activist in Cleveland from Somalia, who has been working very diligently in terms of providing social services in the Cleveland area, was told that she was a permanent resident and that if she didn't become a spy in the mosque, that indeed, if she got as much as a traffic ticket, they were going to arrest her, and she's a widower. She lost her husband during the Somali Civil War, and indicated that they would take her children from her, and with the added, you know, threat, and perhaps they'll be raised by Christians. You know, and she called my house one time late at night, and she was in tears. I think that's horrible. And as I said before, that's only the tip of the iceberg. All across the country, I'm getting the same thing from activists who are working with INS. Cases and so like that, that basically the INS is actually playing the role of also trying to recruit informants for the FBI.
So do you have cases or examples of where these threats that were made against, for example, this Cleveland activist were actually followed through on, not in her case, but in other circumstances?
Yeah, well,
perhaps
her case was actually followed through on, but with a call from a lawyer. Well, we've had some families to be separated as a result of that, and I cannot say in all honesty whether it was a result of trying to recruit for informants, but now I do know people who have been deported who refused to cooperate with the government in those standpoints, and their violations were technical, things that could have been resolved administratively, but no, once the government has their sights on certain persons, and sometimes when they don't cooperate in terms of becoming an informant, then indeed they kind of put their case on a fast track. And I think it's used as also as a psychological mechanism to serve as an example to others. You know, see what happened to this brother, or see what happened to this sister, and it can happen to you. So you best, you know, cooperate when they come along. And also, I think the other thing that I want to really share with you is that I think since the war and the current occupation of Iraq, that the government has been emboldened in terms of its sweeps and its sweeping up of people and visiting of people. There seems to have been an intensification of the intensity in which, you know, the government has now developed a keen interest in what goes on in mosques and what goes on in the Muslim community. It's always been there since 9/11, but I think that they've been emboldened.
How so? Emboldened how?
Emboldened in that the numbers have increased. The amount of visits are increased. The amount of people who are being picked up, you know, and interrogated and being picked up sometimes with no criminal nexus, not even a technical INS violation.
And so what is Azam Abu Hawil's current status?
The current status is he's held in isolation. He's on a 23-hour lockdown. And that's the other thing, too. It's amazing how we can take people who have no criminal history and nothing done criminal and then put them like they're hardened criminals and give them 23-hour lockdown, isolation, and things of that nature. And that seems to be the norm when you take a person who the government is interested in, rather than putting them in a regular, first of all, they shouldn't be detained, period. But if they are going to be detained, rather than putting them in a normal circumstances, which would allow them to have access to the phone and to do other things that they would do if they were in detention, they place them in what we call maximum security type situations. And we have many people who are being detained on administrative, not criminal, not terrorism, just administrative violations, are now being detained in maximum security type atmospheres, which include 23-hour lockdown and occasionally the lights on for 24 hours around the clock.
How does this future look?
The future looks bleak from the standpoint that I don't think that the government is going to stop this level of behavior. However, I'm optimistic that there is indeed a growing community of people of faith and of good conscience. I call it the coalition of conscience, who are going to continue to work to resist these types of tactics. And the other thing, too, I think that many Americans are beginning to wake up from what I call the post 9/11 shock syndrome, and are beginning to realize that something is very drastic in taking place in their country, that the concept of transparency in government has disappeared, the concept of due process and those precious principles of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution are now being shredded under the guise of fighting terrorism and national security. And I think the average American is beginning to wake up and smell the coffee. And so that's where my hope is, that basically that Americans, along with the coalition of conscience, will join together to resist this type of climate of fear, intimidation, and witch hunts that are taking place currently now in our society.
Mahdi Bray, Executive Director of the Muslim American Society. While many Arabs and South Asians experience what they characterize as a crackdown on civil liberties here at home, Sunana Myra of the University of Massachusetts Amherst English Department and the South Asian Center says that immigrant children are among the most outspoken critics of the government's so-called homeland security policies. She spoke recently in Boston at a conference entitled War on Terrorism or Assault on Human Rights.
Immigrant youth do engage in political critique and express dissent, but they may not do so in the spaces we identify as traditional modes or spaces of political activism. For example, at a student assembly organized in a high school on the war on terrorism, three South Asian Muslim students had been working with deliver these eloquent speeches condemning racism to an auditorium filled with their peers. And one Pakistani boy talked about being threatened by some young men in Boston after 9/11 and said, you know, I could have done the same thing, but I don't think it's the right to do. I need to fight back. And he's this kind of muscular young man. And I think when he made this call for nonviolent response at a time when we were going to war in Afghanistan, it was very powerful because it could be taken to be a larger political statement about the U.S. response to 9/11 as well. And South Asian youth are being visibly drawn into race politics and civil rights debates in the local community, I've found. Another Indian immigrant girl stood up in her salwar kameez and said, we have to respect each other if we want to change society. You have to stand up for your rights. These are people who've only been here a couple of years and probably didn't even know what race meant until they got here. So I think it's not clear yet what the impact of this politicization of this generation of immigrant youth will be over time, but a year later, on the anniversary of 9/11, when there was a similar student assembly in this high school I've been working with, two other Indian Muslim girls voluntarily made similar anti-racist speeches that were reported in the local media. So even though these working-class immigrant youth don't have the support of or the time to participate in community or political organizations, they have become spokespersons in the public sphere, willing to voice dissent, as have other Muslim American youth who have been called upon to play the role of educators and public spokespersons. And I found that some of these working-class immigrant youth are willing to voice publicly what some South Asian middle-class community leaders are not willing to say after 9/11. And all the youth I spoke to had a really thoughtful analysis of 9/11 and the U.S. government's bombing of Afghanistan, speaking of it in terms of human rights and resisting the nationalization of 9/11. And Jamila, who's a Bangladeshi girl, said, I felt bad for those people in Afghanistan because they don't have no proof that they actually did it, but they were all killing all these innocent people who had nothing to do with it. And then Alia, who's a Gujarati-American girl who could actually very easily pass for Latina after 9/11, wrote the words, India plus Muslim on her bag. So basically inviting harassment. And for her, this was a gesture of defiance responding to the castings of Muslims as potentially disloyal citizens. And she said to me, just because one Muslim did it in New York, you can't involve everybody in there. You know what I'm saying? And so I think this critique of the anti-Muslim backlash was pervasive amongst the South Asian Muslim youth. And another Muslim girl from India, from Gujarat, Karina, said to me after September 11th, the government hates the Muslims, and I think they want the people to hate the Muslims, like all the Muslims are the same. And there is the sense among some of these young people, and understandably, some of them are hesitant to speak up publicly about issues, given the climate of surveillance and fear we live in, with the Patriot Act, with, you know, some version of Operation TIPS, as Nancy mentioned, in this new Cold War climate, or in this green scare, as some people are calling it. Yet I've found these Muslim immigrant youth to be engaged in a practice of dissenting citizenship, based in a critique and affirmation of human rights that means one has to stand apart at some moments, even as one stands together with others outside the borders of the nation. And in thinking critically about the role of government and the role and rights of citizens in different nations, these youth are performing, in fact, the responsibilities of citizenship, even if they don't actually have a passport. And youth, of course, are a category of citizens whose rights and representations in the media, but also in public discourse, are always negotiated for them, primarily by others, such as institutions or adults. And Muslim immigrant youth, I think, are in an interesting position because they're targets of both the wars on terror and the war on immigration. You remember the war on immigration? And so their dissenting views implicitly critique the imperial feeling of U.S. nationalism after 9/11 through their linking of warfare within the state to international war. And I use this term imperial feeling because I think there's an emerging acknowledgement over the last couple of years of U.S. policy on the global stage as linked to economic and military dominance. And it's a kind of cautious acknowledgement, even in the mainstream media. Even the New York Times uses the word empire and imperialism. Have you noticed this? Which is generally expressed not as a full-blown critique, but as an emerging sentiment in the public sphere, a growing feeling, often an anxiety, that the U.S. is occupying the role of a new empire. And while it's clear that the relations among nation, state, and capital have been transformed since earlier eras of imperialism, the role of U.S. economic and military power, increasingly tied to a unilateral foreign policy and national interests, is not to be underestimated, particularly after the demise of Soviet communism and especially after the events of 9/11, which have led to an increasingly authoritarian exercise of U.S. state power, both at home and abroad. And I think it's this link that we need to focus on, even in this conference. So it's the link between the domestic and imperial that makes this an important mode of dissent, because the project of the new Cold War, as in earlier times, works by obscuring the links between domestic and foreign policies. And people have mentioned the acts from 1996, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, and IRA-IRA, the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, which were already beginning to narrow the definition of civil society in response to this heightened sense of insecurity required to maintain a wartime state after the primary security target disappears. So the distinction between citizens and non-citizens becomes very important because it's needed to support foreign policy and justify the military campaigns and domestic priorities of the U.S. state, such as the battles over welfare, affirmative action, and immigration reform, because these battles obviously are still going on, right? And this is even more true when the illusion of a peacetime economy is discarded for a nation at war, as in the present moment. So the Bush government, as you all know, has implemented new policies for regulating workers and disciplining citizens after 9/11, from stripping due process rights from any persons deemed to be associated with terrorism to mass arrests of Muslim immigrant men complying with the new registration requirements. And this has resulted in a situation where immigrants, undocumented but also legal immigrants, are terrified. And the loss of immigrant rights, I think, has led to a situation in which non-citizens, I'm worried, are particularly vulnerable to hyper-exploitation by employers. I mean, they were already vulnerable before, they were undocumented, but now basically they have no recourse. They can't leave, they can't stay, and they're just afraid of living their lives. And I've heard stories, for example, of documented high school graduates not sure if they can enroll in community college because now community colleges are checking their status. To people, for example, one girl who was afraid she could marry her fiancé because he was undocumented and she didn't know if she would somehow be jeopardizing if she married him. I mean, people are just not able to live their lives. So I think it's important to remember that the state of emergency, this crisis of civil rights and its accompanying mode of dissenting citizenship is in fact, though not exceptional, in the U.S. For the post 9/11 moment, bills and measures and forms of power already in place, and this is a state of everyday life in empire. So there are important continuities before and after 9/11 that I think people here are acknowledging. But in responding to this latest crisis linking U.S. national policy to international policy, I think there are two things to consider. One is that we may not be able to expect the targets of the war on terror or the war on immigration to always march with us or to publicly denounce the crisis as we may want them to do, as some did in previous civil rights movements. For the apparatus of the state has found a way to simply remove people from the public sphere, building on tactics of surveillance that they used in the 60s. Clearly, immigrants have found a way to organize with great courage. I'm not just saying that they're all sitting at home in the face of the threats used by the state to suppress dissent. And one group organizing against the deportations of Cambodian refugees in California used the simple slogan, which I find very powerful, "We will not be moved." We will not be moved. The second issue that I want to emphasize is that it is not enough to make the case that civil liberties are in need of protection in the face of arguments that we need to turn them in exchange for the illusion of national security. And this is a complicated issue that I've been struggling with, so I'd really like to know what you think. I think there are many people who are too willing to give up civil rights in for the feeling of security. And so I think we need to take a political stand that it is the principle of social and racial justice that we are not willing to sacrifice, a principle that I think not all civil libertarians necessarily care about. It's also clear that the new patriotism is multiracial and that, in fact, the divides are no longer just between black and white or just between white versus people of color, but between Muslim versus non-Muslim, citizen versus non-citizen, or undocumented versus documented immigrants. And we have to be willing to say that we will not let the issue of safety and concern for nation divide us based on religion, race, class, or citizenship, because if we do, I think we allow for a jagged chasm to exist between the two nations emerging under Ashcroft. Thank you.
Sunana Myra of the University of Massachusetts Amherst English Department and the South Asian Center. She spoke in Boston at a conference entitled War on Terrorism or Assault on Human Rights. Special thanks to Mark Weaver of community radio station WMBR for production assistance with that report.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed 1,000,000 men and now they want me back again, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore. No, I ain't marching anymore.
Yesterday was Memorial Day, a time for reflection and remembrance of those who have died in past wars. Peace Watch reporter Eddie Becker went to a commemoration of the day at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial here in the nation's capital. Eddie grew up before the Vietnam War, and he remembers marching alongside with his father, a World War II veteran, in his hometown's Veterans Day parade to a circle of trees, each planted in the name of a veteran who didn't return.
Here in Washington, D.C., Veterans Day has become some sort of nightmarish motorcycle rally with gas spitting, choppers gunning their engines, racing up and down Constitution Avenue. They call it Rolling Thunder, and I think it was started by Papa Bush's Vice President Dan Quayle, who teamed up with radio talk show host G. Gordon Liddy. Many of the participants look like Hell's Angels, so I'm sure most are just regular guys with Harleys. I first learned about the war in Vietnam from returning soldiers. They said that it wasn't like a John Wayne movie. They were made to do inhumane things that haunted them and still haunt them today. American society didn't want to hear about it. These were the voices who were being drowned out by rolling thunder. These were the patriots who wanted to heal the wounds and to make peace with their former enemies.
Between the flashbacks and nightmares, you hear the screams and the yells and the smells and everything. And it just got to me, and I couldn't do it anymore. And I just held it in and carried it with me, not only the anger, but the pain and the hurt and the sorrow.
Michael Pagolo finally went to counseling, made peace with his former enemies and with himself, went to Vietnam, and now counsels others.
I see some veterans have gone for the help, and I see the happiness in their face and eyes. And then I see the brothers that haven't dealt with it yet, and I see the pain, and it also pains.
I'm sorry.
It also pains me to see them with the pain. I know where they could be, and it's hard, and we don't have to live in that pain.
I see men and women that are wounded physically, but more so I see men and women that are wounded emotionally, and not just nurses and soldiers, but their family members.
Charlene Edwards wrote a book about people healing from the Vietnam War called Voices from Vietnam.
The vet carries with them the pain from the war and gifts that to their children and their wives or their husbands, and the pain continues. And it's just time for our country and the Vietnamese people and anyone that has been hit with some kind of trauma in their life to begin to heal.
Through my experience, I carried the same hate in me for the Vietnamese people, for Jane Fonda, you know, for the people that protest the war. And through therapy, that was my stuff, not their stuff. You know, and we don't like to go into therapy because we know of the pain that we're going to have to go through and kick up what happened in Vietnam. And in Vietnam, a lot of innocent people were killed.
We met at my house. He was my boss's boss, and he'd pick me up for a photo shoot. And within a couple hours, he shared Vietnam with me. And it was the first time he talked about it and the first day since the war ended that he cried about it.
The time I met Charlene, I never spoke about Vietnam. And at that time, I was thinking about committing suicide because that's how much Vietnam was bothering me.
And within a couple of days, I got some brochures from a friend of mine that ran a counseling service and handed him the brochures. I said, you have three choices. You can either take these and throw them away. You can take them, read them, and throw them away. Or you can take them, read them, make an appointment, and save your life. And the next day, he had an appointment with my friend and started his counseling and saved his life. And he gives me credit for it, but I give him credit because it took him more courage to go and get on the road to healing.
People do hear you because I had a veteran I spoke to 3 years ago who was one of the presidents of Rolling Thunder. And during 9/11, he called me up and he says, you know, I spoke to you 3 years ago. I'm in trouble and I need help. And you told me you had cards for a therapist. Can you send me the card? So people do see it. The vets do see it in other vets. And some reach out and some, like I said, don't.
And eventually, 10 years later, after tens of thousands of miles to American Canada and three trips to Vietnam, the book Voices from Vietnam has come to be. And it is completely about healing the wounds from the war. And the back of the book, there's a resource guide that gives avenues for veterans and Vietnamese and Amerasians to go for services such as counseling.
Charlene Edwards and Michael Pagolo, whose relationship eventually led to them becoming husband and wife. They spoke with Peace Watch reporter Eddie Becker at yesterday's Memorial Day ceremonies here in the nation's capital. For more information on Charlene and Michael's story, you can go to their website at www.voicesfromvietnam.com. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hamid of KPFA, Reem Kathuta, Kata Mester, and Pauline Bartoloni. Thanks for Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to support Peace Watch, we urge you to make a pledge through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. Send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.